Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 7th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Vegetation Zones and Change. Session 3 of Plants of the North Cascades, presented by Joe Arnett. Let's listen in.
And because these topics are really interesting, so we can spend as many people do the rest of their lives understanding plant life in an area. So I have a fairly big agenda for the day. What I'd like to do is, first of all, stand way back from the North Cascades and just look at the vegetation that occupies the site and give you a little bit of a picture of how that vegetation distributes itself. And every place is different. If you walk into the forest behind the lodge here and look at the trees and the plants, so that's going to be different in very, very distinct ways from another place 50 yards down the river. But as we study vegetation over a large area, it's pretty easy to put things into some broad classes. And I think it's helpful to understand, to go to a place and look at it, to understand how it fits into this big picture. So that's what I'd like to give you first, is a big picture of vegetation of the mountains. And I have a cross-section here of the North Cascades. If you've hiked up into the mountains recently, you realize they are pretty steep. Not quite as steep overall as my drawing. And then, After getting that sort of general picture of the vegetation, I wanted to look at change, because what we're seeing right now is a little snapshot in time, but things are changing dramatically. Sometimes over long periods of time, geologic time, sometimes very short periods of time, like a few days, like in the case of a fire, it can be a very dramatic change in the vegetation in that regard too. So I wanted to look at how this snapshot we look at is really a glimpse of a very dramatically changing picture. I'll try to give you a little bit of sense of this process of change. So to start out, if we were to back away from the Cascades and look at them, we would see that basically the vegetation is forested, but the forest has boundaries. So I wanted to start with that, just to give these two boundaries. And these are sort of like diagrammatically showing the limits of trees. And trees don't grow above this upper line or below this lower line. So we call these tree lines. And they exist for different reasons. The lower tree line, the lower limit of tree growth is limited by moisture. So below this point in elevation on both sides of the mountains, the environmental limitation is moisture, lack of. It's just too dry for trees to grow below this line. Now, if you've been to Western Washington, you might be a little puzzled by this one over here, because Western Washington is the most well-developed forest in the world, maybe. But there are very limited areas, even in Western Washington, where on a microsite level, it's too dry for trees to grow. And these are usually rocky balls, like along the saltwater, sometimes in the grassy slopes, up in the lower hills. Usually there the soil is so thin and they're so exposed to the south and to the wind that trees aren't able to become established there. There's also a biological element in this lower tree line, and that's fire, because the effect of fire tends to move that line up and down. And you really can see it most over along the Puget Sound area where it's forested, but you can also see it out in the sagebrush country, which is very extensive, hundreds of thousands of square miles of area where it's too dry for trees. And even out there, sometimes fire is a big player in what happens. And then the upper tree line is limited by the lack of heat. If we go up into the mountains and we climb up above all the trees and find that area where there aren't any trees, even above those meadows that have patches of trees, but where there really are no more trees, the environmental limit there is heat. That in the summertime it's just too cold for plants to support tree growth. It really isn't how cold it is in the winter, because plants can really adapt. People from the Midwest must know this well. They can really adapt to severe cold. But they have to have a certain amount of heat during the summertime to support trees. So those are the limits of the forest. And we call that area below the lower tree line the steppe. And steppe is just a word that means about the same thing as grassland. Steppe is a plant community that's dominated by grass. And we have a lot of shrubs out there too. The shrubs we find come and go depending on what's happening. But the grassland is the dominant vegetation. Above the upper tree line, we call that area the alpine. By definition, now these are sort of botanical terms, and in general discussion, if you talk about alpine, you just mean mountainous. And so you could say these are alpine areas and we have alpine trees. But in a botanical sense, we use that term very specifically to mean beyond trees. So in a technical sense, there's no such thing as an alpine tree, because alpine means beyond the trees. So just a little distinction in general usage and technical usage. So those are the limits of the forest. There's another line that I'll stick in here, which is called the forest line. And this is less distinct, but this is like the limit of the closed forest. So if you walk up into Copper Basin, or if you go up to Holden Lake, you'll start to find areas where the forest breaks up and there's meadows, and there's patches of trees, and then there's stands of trees, and then meadows again. Very beautiful area in the mountains, lots of lush flowering at certain times of the year. That line is not caused by the lack of heat, the way the alpine is, but it's caused by snowpack. And I'll show you some photos later which show how climatic change, even short-term climatic change, if it affects the amount of snowpack, affects where this forest line is. There's lots of places in the North Cascades where trees are invading those meadows. Not in a negative sense of an invasion, but they're occupying those meadows. Because there's years where the snowpack is light. And a very dramatic time in our recent history was during the Dust Bowl era. You know, we think of the Dust Bowl as being like an agricultural event or even an economic event, you know, connected to the Depression and all that. But actually, the Dust Bowl was a period of drought where the vegetation of the North Cascades responded to the Dust Bowl. There were a number of years where it was warmer and drier. Snow melted out of those meadows early, and trees were able to get established. So we can go into a lot of those meadows and find trees of different species, different sizes even. It's really hard to tell age by size. And find that many of those date right back to the Dust Bowl, where they get established. So that kind of narrows us down to the forest. And I'm going to draw a line here in the forest. And it's a very indistinct and fuzzy line, like a lot of things if you study biology. We can describe these different kinds of communities, but sometimes the line between them is really fuzzy. If we were down here, we would definitely see one kind of forest that I'll call the lower montane. Or sometimes it's called a temperate, probably even a better term, temperate. And in our case, coniferous forest. And then above this line, we can definitely find a forest which we could call upper montane. Or again, a better word, I think, is boreal forest. You know the term boreal?
Pardon? From the north?
From the north. It just means the northern forest. And in the mountains, you know, the vegetation is divided by elevation, because that's where it gets gets cold at high elevation, warm at low elevation. But as you go north on the continent, you find the same change, or very similar change. So our upper montane forest is very similar to the northern forest all across North America. We have slightly different species in some cases, or in some cases we have the same species. But it's very analogous. Just like the temperate forest, which extends to the south, is what we find at lower elevation in our mountains. So I'm going to describe just a little bit about, I'll show you some pictures of these different zones and show you how they look differently. And maybe the product for me would be if you went out in the forest, you could get a sense where you are in this continuum. I could ask you, well, where do you think Holden sits? And maybe I'll wait till I describe this to see if you can figure where Holden might fit in this continuum, if we're down in the steppe, or if we're up in the alpine, or if we're in one of these forests. So let me do that first. I'll show you a few pictures. It always seems like a shame to come to the mountains and turn off, you know, pull the shades and look at pictures of the mountains. But I'll do that very briefly, just because I like to take it from out in the grassland up into the alpine, and it'd be hard to do that in an hour. I think even with a helicopter, it would be a pretty fast trip. So if somebody could just close that one curtain for me. And Carmen, if you could turn on the light of the projector.
The what?
There's a switch on the projector that's the light. The fan is on now, but
on your left.
Over to your left. Just pull that forward.
Over to my left.
Forward. Yeah, the top button.
Okay.
Push it toward. There we go.
No power on.
That's it. That's great. So this is kind of an overview, and this is actually this is Mount Stewart, but this is showing just a standing back in the distance. Actually, Mount Stewart is so steep and rugged that you don't really see very much forest. You can see some little remnants here creeping up. Here's a little bit of forest coming in, but this is just a picture to show you the mountains from a distance. And then if we bring it closer to home, we'll start out in this little cross section or walk across the mountains. We'll start down along Lake Chelan. And this is over somewhere just north of Prince Creek. And you can see little patches of grassland right in here. And probably, you know, 100 years ago before we were so good at suppressing fire, probably these grasslands were much more extensive. Because grasses are very resistant to fire, where the woody plants aren't. So when fire goes through here, they tend to have much more extensive grasslands. And this is also along a similar part of Lake Chelan. Scattered trees, really dominated by grasses, which are drying out. And scattered trees, this is a ponderosa pine, which is our most fire-resistant tree and most drought-resistant tree. And it was probably more common along the lake before, well, certainly more common before fire and suppression. And then there's a scattering of shrubs. The definition botanists use, or ecologists use for desert, is an environment that's dominated by shrubs, not by grasses. So we don't technically have desert in Washington. Again, that's just the technical use of the term. People can certainly use it in a general sense to describe any dry place. But shrubs are a big part of the communities along the lake, too. So that's a little bit of a step of grassland. And this is obviously not along Lake Chelan, this is out in the San Juan Islands. But I wanted to give you, it's a little dark photo. Actually, I'll have to turn it over. Yellow Island, which is up in San Juan's. It's a little nature conservancy reserve. But very similar in a lot of ways to the grasslands along Lake Chelan. And, you know, this region is all forested, but these places where the soils are thin and it's very dry, and there's been that effect of fire, there are these little patches of grassland. And this is down by the Columbia Gorge, another place. It's a south-facing slope, really dry, really exposed to the wind. You know, Columbia Gorge wind is kind of like Lake Chelan wind. It blows almost all the time. And the south slope is totally grasses and
herbaceous plants. The north slope, where it's protected and shady, it's all forest. So this is like the forest line, or the lower tree line. And tens of thousands of square miles of Washington and Oregon, Idaho, are occupied by this place where there is no forest. It's all sagebrush and grass. This is in, this is great. It's a dry place. Lots of miles, miles and miles of sagebrush. Sagebrush doesn't survive fire, so if there is fire in these habitats, the sagebrush eventually gets lost completely. And so you have just a grassland. And there's been some big areas of Washington very recently that have been converting back to pure grassland because of fire. This is in Grand Coulee too. It's kind of like the Alpine. It's a really beautiful place for a very short period of time because everything flowers when the moisture is there. And so in late April, early May, it's really showy. And there's the forest in behind. So it's just below the tree line. There's even cactus out here, a couple of species of cactus. And lots of flowering plants. Now we'll come back to Lake Chelan, try to bring it back to the local place. And this is one of the many canyons along the lake where you have grassland up in the exposed bulbs or bluffs, and then where you drop down into stream canyons, it's a very dramatic change in vegetation as you walk down in there because it's a little more moist and it's forested. Mostly in this case by maples. And then you come into what's really that lower montane or temperate forest. And this could just as well be taken just below the village here. It's a Douglas fir and ponderosa pine forest. And those are the two primary species of that lower montane forest. So Douglas fir is what this fir of bark is here and here. And ponderosa pine, which this is right here, pretty similar looking, but we can see the whole plant. It's pretty easy to tell them apart.
Does ponderosa always have the reddish bark?
When they get bigger, yeah, okay. Generally pretty much reddish.
Because there's other varieties of pines.
There's other species of pine. There's a couple others that grow right here.
Okay.
In fact, more than a couple others.
Yeah.
The, always have to hesitate with that word always. You know, anything in nature tends to have exceptions to the rules. But in general, ponderosa is really red when you see it from the distance. And the size. In moister places, you have western red cedar, just like behind the lodge here. This could be right behind the lodge. It isn't, but generally being found in more moist places, but red cedar is really drought resistant, and we sometimes see it in very dry sites. It's not limited to moist places. And this is kind of another picture of that lower montane or temperate forest. And this is Salal. It's a really dry forest, this particular one. Salal is the understory. Douglas fir is the main tree. This isn't a very old forest. It's probably burned, you know, 80 years ago or something, and this is what's grown ever since then. And then places in these lower forests where you do have some moisture, a little bit of ground moisture. Quaking aspen is a real common occurrence. If you go along Lake Chelan and find little pockets of moisture down in these dry forests, you'll find quaking aspen. And up here behind the village, there's some quaking aspen, a place where there's a little moisture coming out. Now this is a little harder to see in the photograph, so it's kind of just to use it to tell you about it, but this is a little higher elevation. This is over across the lake, starting up in the Sawtooth Ridge, but this is getting into that boreal forest. And there's a shift in species of trees and a shift in species of things under the trees. The biggest trees here are subalpine fir, which is also a common tree here in the village. And the understory, there's a white rhododendron, is a real common component of that. If you walk up like to Copper Basin, part way up there, you start getting the forest, it's just like this. This picture could be taken on the trail of Copper Basin. subalpine fir, white-rhododendron. Where that line is on the ground is not distinct, but you can definitely find your place in itself. You can find yourself in this upper forest and see that it's very distinct from the lower forest. This is another picture of it. Actually, this photo is from Alaska, but it's a similar white rhododendron. It's a prominent component of the understory. There's also a thing called fool's huckleberry. It's called that because it looks like a huckleberry, but it doesn't produce any fruit. Or it doesn't produce any berries, it produces fruit. And then you get up into the place where those meadows begin. And to many people, these are the most beautiful places in the mountains. Anybody know what that bird is? Any birders in here?
Campworm.
Clark's jay?
No. I don't think it's a Clark's. I think it's a gray jay. But when I looked at it, I had the same question. I thought, is that a Clark's nutcracker or is that a gray jay? I think it's a gray jay. The Clark's are usually a little more aloof than the gray jays. That could be in Copper Basin. It's actually over in a place called Hoodoo Basin, which is on the other side of the lake. But
you've never seen the river, the stream kind of winds like that.
That's right, just like in Copper Basin, there's that stream that meanders
Copper
through.
Basin, yeah.
Right. Very flat bottom, carved out by glaciers. But you know where this is? It's a little overexposed, but.
Is it over near Image Lake?
Yeah, it's on the way to Image Lake. That's Miner's Ridge. And this is really one of the most developed subalpine places I've seen. It's really just a beautiful garden of all these herbaceous plants. And you can see you're not really above the trees. Here's a tree up here, and there's trees up in there. But this is a huge meadow that's caused by accumulation of snow. And so in general, the trees haven't been able to invade that place. Things like lupin and Indian paintbrush and mountain distort.
This looks like a painting, the way you expose it there.
Right, yeah, that's true. A little impressionistic overexposure. Yeah.
What does that word herbaceous mean in terms of plants?
Herbaceous just means plants that aren't woody.
Not woody.
Yeah, so every year they die to the ground. And grasses are herbaceous, and with the exception of something like bamboo. And a lot of the flowering plants in those meadows are herbaceous. This is another picture of subalpine. And this is over at Lake Juanita, which is over on Sawtooth Ridge across the lake also. But the vegetation is a lot like you'd see up here in Copper Basin, particularly, because there's subalpine larch and subalpine fir, two main tree line species. If you read in the books, they call this alpine larch. And I always call it subalpine for the reason I described earlier, but maybe it's a good time to point out that there's in Bonnie there's no formalization of common names, so you can, no standardization, so you really can call something anything you want, which is kind of nice to have that freedom. Scientific names, on the other hand, there is a very definite structure and procedure for naming things scientifically. Of course, if you want to communicate with somebody else, it might be good if you use the same name they use for it, but. So I feel very free calling it subalpine larch.
Larch is an evergreen.
Larch, there's a little confusion of terminology. We use the term evergreen, and we use the term coniferous, deciduous. Evergreen just means a tree that's green year-round.
Right.
So larch is not evergreen because it loses its needles every fall. But it is coniferous, like pines and firs and spruces. So it's a deciduous conifer. And larch is it's really a remarkable tree. If we were in Western Washington at this elevation, or relative elevation, there'd be no trees. But subalpine larch is a big upright tree at very high elevation, beyond anything else that's able to grow upright.
What elevation is that?
This is probably around 7,000 feet. 7,400 feet, something like that. But part of its strategy for surviving in that environment is that it does lose its needles in the wintertime. The other thing I wanted to point out about this picture, and later I'm going to, if I have time, I'd like to talk a little bit more about change.
No needles in the wintertime?
No needles in the wintertime. Yeah.
They fall off
trees. And sometimes where they've been planted in the cities, people see the needles fall off, think the tree has died, and cut it down. So this particular tree doesn't grow very well in the city, so it isn't usually successfully grown. But there's other larches that are. The other thing about this picture is there was a, I told you about the Dust Bowl. This is an area where you can see some of that invasion, especially in this, unfortunately, this picture is kind of over the hill, so you have to use your imagination a little bit. But over here, there's some big stands of larch that have been dated back to that period. So it's really changing. The forest is really moving upwards in the mountains. You probably know where this is if you know where Miners Ridge is.
Image Lake?
Yep, this is Image Lake in Glacier Peak. And this is classic subalpine. Lots of trees, patches of trees, and also lots of really large meadow. And you'll notice that the trees are usually not in the basins, but on the ridges. And that's because these melt out earlier, and so trees can get established. But down in the basin, where the snowpack lies later, the trees haven't been able to get started. I guess this also illustrates maybe some of why we really go to the mountains, which may not necessarily be the study of the plants, but really just because it's such a beautiful place. This is a whitebark pine. It's another tree line species, really high growing, high in elevation. It tends to grow on the south side of a ridge, where the larch tends to grow on the north side of the ridge. In lots of places in these mountains, if you find a ridge that's east-west, then on one side you'll have a grassy whitebark pine forest, and on the other side you'll have a kind of a snowy subalpine larch. And then we're getting up to the upper, very near the upper tree line, and into what's really the alpine. And this is on South Navarre Peak, which is over, again, across the lake. And it's around 7,500 feet, something like that. And there's still a few stunted trees. They use this term crumholtz. These are still fairly upright, but right on the limit of what you call a tree. There's a term crumholtz, which means crooked wood. And that is a term that's applied to these stunted and twisted trees that grow up at the very limit of tree growth. And then typical alpine vegetation is really low to the ground, where there's a little bit more moisture, a little bit less severe wind, and a little more warmth. And so plants are able to survive and get established. If you look beyond this picture, just to put it in a context, this is the Columbia River right here, or one of the lakes that form the root of the Columbia River now.
Is that Lorsch Land?
No, it's actually looking, it's to the north and east of Chelan. This is the Waterville Plateau right here, near Washington. Big wheat growing country. Yeah. So for standing here, you're really above all the forest, but you're looking to this grassland, which is below all the forest. Big wheat growing country in the Waterville Plateau. And up in the alpine, you have really plants that have really adapted in quite remarkable ways to growing in the severe environment. This is a type of willow. This is like a willow tree. It's called net-leaf willow. It's about an inch tall. And in the Arctic and in the alpine, there's lots of species of willow that have been able to adapt and adapt by growing in very small forms. And that other, the showy plant there is a lupin that also may be like 3 or 4 inches tall. Other adaptations, and in nature, it just seems to be a case that there's not one strategy that survives or that works. Many different strategies tend to work, and biologically, things tend to take all kinds of different pathways to survive. The willow has taken the pathway of, first of all, becoming very reduced so that it can grow in these alpine areas. But also, it's got really waxy leaves to conserve moisture. The lupin has taken another route where it's gotten really hairy. And we think, anyway, that this hairiness on a lot of alpine plants is partially to break down the ultraviolet light, give some protection from ultraviolet radiation, and also to conserve moisture, because all that hairiness slows the water flow down along the surface. So those are alpine adaptations. Classic alpine plant, moss campion. And this plant grows in our mountains pretty commonly if you get up high enough. And it grows to the very limit of tree of plant growth in North America. If you go way up in Ellesmere Island, north of Hudson's Bay, this is a common plant up there. So a lot of our mountain plants have come from the alpine, or from the Arctic, really. And this one, too, this is a type of lupin. It's only a couple inches high. You might notice that there's quite a few photos of the alpine and not too many of the forest. And that's because our eyes are kind of attracted to those, to the colors, the flowers. And this plant has a really great name. This is a type of mustard. It's called Smolowskia. It's not a very appealing name. It's named after a Russian botanist. But Smolowskia is both its common name and its scientific genus. And it's the highest, the plant that, in my experience, is grows at the highest elevation in the North Cascades.
How low would it be, though?
Oh, in low elevation?
No, I mean, no, what would be the limit?
Well, you know, a lot of things, if they are given the opportunity, like if the seeds wash down, you'll find them very rarely down along streams at quite low elevation. Mm-hmm. You know, we find alpine plants growing along the outwash of Prince Creek and Fish Creek and things like that. But usually it's up above around 7,000 feet. Both on, the two places I've seen it at the limit was Mount Adams, southern volcano in Washington. It's the last plant that was growing on the side of Mount Adams. And every mountain I've ever gone up in the Cascades, or certainly almost every one, it's been among the last plants. It's a very adaptive. And this is just to show you the most developed alpine area that I know of in Washington. This is Burroughs Mountain by Mount Rainier. If you've ever been up there, been to Sunrise. It's one of those easy places to get to. I mean, you can drive almost to the alpine in a car, and then you can walk out 2-3 miles along this really extensive alpine area. It's a really beautiful place. And these are closer to home. I just wanted to close the slide portion of this with a couple local pictures. This is from North Star Peak, looking over Glacier Peak. And this one is Cloudy Pass, and I recognize that. Cloudy Pass, looking across Cloudy Pass over to Glacier Peak. So that's an overview of the North Cascades. And we have a little bit of time. I'd like to talk a little bit about change. So if you could turn that, somebody just turn the light off and leave the fan on. Let's talk a little bit about change. Because this is a very much a moving picture.
You want the fan on?
Yeah. Might leave it on just for a minute. Just sorry to turn the lights on. There's a little bit of tension up on your sleep. Thanks. So here's the picture. Here's the cross section going from the alpine down to the steppe or grassland. And it's kind of like a biology lecture. You know? These are the terms that we've covered: alpine, subalpine, forest line, where the forest starts to open up, tree line, the limits of tree growth. But a big part of the story really is change. And I wanted to say a little bit about disturbance. And I use that word disturbance. It's kind of hard to find a good word that doesn't have some kind of a negative connotation. You think of disturbance as kind of being something that's not good. And that may not be the case, but it's just something that happens. And one of the biggest disturbances is fire. And sometimes that does have a negative effect if we happen to be in a path of fire ourselves. But we think fire was really a frequent occurrence, particularly low elevation along the lake. There's a lot of evidence. There's places where the fire frequency might have been as frequent as even 5 years, you know, 5 year fire cycle. And a lot of those may have been caused by lightning, and probably a lot of those were also caused by people, either intentionally lighting fires because of ecological change they wanted, or just carelessness with fire, and fires would burn and it wouldn't have a big effect. It's really hard to talk about nature without talking about people, because people really are part of nature and have been here probably as long as the forests have been here. You know, we think the glaciers receded about 14,000 years ago, and there's evidence of people being here about 10,000 years ago. And it's very likely they were here before they left any evidence that we found. So almost as soon as there was a forest, there were people that had some effect on it. And fire is one of the big effects throughout Washington. So I want to look a little bit at the disturbance of fire. There's other types of disturbance too, which we're really aware of in Washington now since about 1980, which is volcanic activity. Have anybody been to Mount St. Helens? And what amazing, quote, disturbance in that place. And it's really interesting to go there and see how intense that was, and also see how things are coming back. And that's been a very frequent event in Washington, with volcanic eruptions. And the plant life is really adapted to it. Succession is just a term we use that is how things reoccupy a site. If you have a fire, or if you have volcanic activity, which just removes the vegetation, things right away start coming back. And succession is that development over time of a forest. And you might have a certain kind of forest that establishes itself really quickly, and then over time that forest changes. And there is this idea of a climax forest, or equilibrium, you know, where if things don't get disturbed, eventually this is the forest you end up with. It's really an abstraction in our own mind, because disturbance really is part of the story. So there may never be a climax or equilibrium forest. There's always these cycles of change, disturbance, succession. Another agent of change, or way things change, is migration. And I'm thinking relative to plant migration, but also migration of other types of organisms, particularly us. But as plants move into an area, they may cause profound changes. We think after the glaciers receded, all the plants that are here basically migrated in, one by one, species by species. And some of them might have migrated from short distance away. Like, they may have found refugia in the mountains, places where they could continue to grow and then recolonize. Or some of them might have come here from Europe or Asia, often by human agents. But we have a lot of species that are here now that have come over since Europeans have come here. And they're a part of the ecology, and they always will be. And then the last change is genetic change. And usually we think of genetic change as being very slow. But there's lots of change that's continually happening as biological and abiotic forces sort of mold the genetics of an organism or a species. So that's another agent of change. I have a few pictures of fire, you know, other disturbance. I thought if we had some time, I'd show you those too. Fire is a big topic in the West, as you all know, no doubt. And as you probably also know, we think there was a historic frequency of fire that was much greater than what we see now. And about 100 years ago, we started becoming more and more able to control fire and put them out. And so that led to a development of conditions very different than what we had before that. And that by itself isn't good or bad, I don't believe, but one of the dangers that we've seen all over the West is because we've stopped putting out fires, there's been accumulation of debris or fuel dead fuel, and also a much denser forest established. So when fire does happen, there's much more likely that it's going to be a real intense fire. And the biggest threat to us is if we happen to live in those places, that we're at risk. And so there's big efforts around the West to try to change the conditions to one that's safer for people. Even if you're not concerned about natural processes or, you know, natural systems, which people are concerned about, it also puts, you know, human life at greater risk. So that's a lot of what's going on in the West. If you want to turn that back on, I'll just show a few pictures of fire around here and other places. And, I might need to, I'm not sure if it's next to the, I might need to jump around and find where they start. Well, I'll start from here, and partially I'll talk about fire, and partially I'll just talk about change. This is Lake Chelan, and this is over by, this is Prince Creek right here. Comes in on the other side of the lake. This is a little patch of manzanita, which is a tall manzanita. It's about 8 feet tall. There's a guy standing there, in his sense of scale. It's the only patch, or I have to say was, the only patch of manzanita on Lake Chelan, the only patch of manzanita I've ever seen in Washington, was growing in this one place. 2 years ago, there was a pretty hot fire went down the lake and completely burned this band. But manzanita is a fire-adapted species, and it adapts by sprouting. The roots aren't usually killed unless it's a really, really hot fire. And so I've yet to go over there to see if this patch has survived. But we think this is a remnant of a time around 6,000 years ago when the climate was a lot warmer and a lot of southern species moved up north. They call this the hypsothermal interval. You might have heard of that term. But about halfway back to the glaciation, it's really hot and dry. And right along Lake Chelan, right at the stretch, we find lots of little remnant populations of southern species. There's a fern growing here. You can't see it in the photo, but it's the only place in Washington that's found. There's a little lady's tresses orchid that's also a southern species. So it's very interesting to see these little pockets. This is a little pocket of mountain hemlock and silver fir. And this is a remnant, we think, of when the climate was colder. This is up above Cub Lake over on the Sawtooth Ridge on the other side. But it's the only patch, or one of two patches I know of these kinds of trees anywhere near the area. The rest of them were way to the west or way to the north. So we think that when the climate goes through these pulses of getting cold, getting hot, that you get little pockets that manage to survive when the conditions are destroyed. And this is a cold, kind of cold, snowy north slope. And so we have these remnants. And I don't know when this could be from immediately post-glacial. It's probably when it is from, because there have been periods of cold since the glaciers, but nothing as prolonged as what it would take probably to get this area. This is another subalpine larch, and I was just showing this again to show these climatic fluctuations. This is a really old dead snag. I can't even guess how old that tree was. And here's this whole forest that's been coming in, and it's probably dating back to the Dust Bowl. So going back like to around the 30s, early 1930s. So again, showing that change due to climatic fluctuation. This is a change due to disease, which we can think of disease as a disturbance, even without putting that negative connotation on it. That there's several diseases that attack white pines. And this is a white bark pine. And you'll see that a lot of these dead trees, they were just killed, and the subalpine fir that grows with them was not affected. But if you go through this site now, you'll also see that there are new white bark pines coming back. So it's not like it wiped out the species, but it definitely changed the composition. And now we get to the fire disturbance. This is a photo of what we call the toilet paper fire. 1984. You might have heard about this fire if you've been around here. You've heard about it. There are a couple of guys that just graduated from Harvard Medical School in, I believe, 84, or maybe 85. I guess it was 85. And they were taking a hike along the lake, and one form of backcountry hygiene is to burn your toilet paper. But don't do it if it's a very dry place. And that's what these guys did, and they just got caught the forest on fire. And burned, I think it was around 5,000 acres. It wasn't a huge fire. But you can see, this is on the ground, looking at that fire about 2 years later, 2 or 3 years later. And it's recovering. Obviously, it's going to take a long time for those trees to grow back. But this is a big leaf maple. Big leaf maple is an amazing plant. It grows in so many kinds of places. And it's really able to adapt to fire. It sprouts vigorously after fire. And so the tree was killed to the ground. But then from below, where the roots weren't killed, they sent up new shoots. And most of the big leaf maple we see, even the big ones out here, you know, in the dry side of the mountains, are like big shrubs. They have multiple stems. It's not like a single trunk tree. This is another picture of the same thing. Here's the dead tree, and even it was multiple trunks. So probably there was some time in the past a seed that started growing this tree. Fire came through, burned off the tree, it sprouted multiple trunks, and then another fire came through and it sprouted multiple trunks again. So it's really adapted. Another adaptation, ponderosa pine wasn't killed by the fire. So ponderosa pine has really thick, resistant bark. Fire comes through. If they're not packed too closely, they may not be damaged at all, really. They may just thin the understory a little bit. And there's a Douglas fir. Douglas fir is also very resistant to fire. Not as resistant as ponderosa. But once it attains a certain size, it can withstand a lot of burning without being killed. And this is a live tree, and it's really been charred by fire, but it's doing fine. Probably that fire benefited it because it removed some of the competition and also released some nutrients in the soil. This is just across the lake. If you walk through the woods here, in fact, even just below the village, there's some good examples. You'll find a few big Douglas fir and ponderosa pine that have fire chars. And then you'll find a whole forest underneath them of young Douglas fir. And that's really the forest story of the whole West, where there was a frequent occurrence of fire. And once we stopped letting those fires burn, this whole forest came up around them. There's another sort of picture of a different adaptation of fire, or to fire. This is a place where there was a fire, and it essentially killed all the trees on the site. There's a charred stump. This one didn't survive the fire. But another adaptation is where a species will come in and occupy the whole site after a fire. You have this bare ground, no vegetation competition, mineral soil, perfect conditions for lodgepole pine. And that's how lodgepole pine usually gets started, is you have an intense fire and it seeds in. They call these dog hair stands. And you can see maybe why they call them dog hair. It'd be a dog with very stiff hair, but they just grow so densely that they completely shade out the understory. And there's lots of these right around here in the valley. If you walk up to Holden Lake, there's one dog hair stand of lodgepole you go through.
I've always wondered about that area down kind of below Holden, you know, around Holden Creek.
Yeah.
Everything looks the same. Does that mean there was a fire there fairly recently? Those aren't really old trees.
Well, you know, it's really hard to say how old the tree is. It's quite amazing sometimes. You know, I've cored, in fact, I meant to bring in my increment core. I have a tool for making a core in trees. And then you can count the rings without damaging the tree. And some of these forests, they get to a point where they grow fairly fast at first, and then they almost stop. Mm-hmm. And the growth gets really slow. And I've seen many trees well, over on the other side of the lake where I was doing the study this year, you know, 8 inches in diameter that are around 100 years old. Mm-hmm. And also a surprising thing is sometimes you'll have, if it's a mixed stand, you'll have fairly large trees and fairly small ones that all turn out to be about the same age, which has been a surprise to me, even different species. So I couldn't even guess the age. You'd have to go and core it.
But you would assume that was a fire?
Yeah. Okay. Huh. Oh yeah, I definitely assume that was a fire. And it was a stand replacing fire, where it takes everything out. Mm-hmm. Where these lower elevation, where you have, you know, remnant trees, which are still alive, that's just a kind of a low intensity, kind of a clearing out kind of fire. And both of those are natural. Both of those happen historically. Our human interest, it's in our human interest to try to establish a low intensity fire for our own protection, basically, for no other reason. Another picture of Doghair stand, lodgepole pine. One has a little bit of understory. Douglas fir will also do this at lower elevation. This is, lodgepole is a little higher elevation, like from the village up. But low elevation Douglas fir will do the same thing. And often there will be no understory at all, not a blade of grass. It'll be so dense and so shaded that there's just Douglas fir, single species forests, you know, for maybe tens of acres. Not huge. And this I just threw in to show you another adaptation. This is a rare plant growing here. A lot of these seedlings are a type of a globe mallow. It's called Iliamna longicepula. It's a scientific name. And I think it's called long sepaled globe mallow. And this was a historic site where there were some rare plants reported. I think the first sighting forms showed like 6 plants, something like that. So this is over near Antioch, and there was a fire through there a few years ago, and I was asked to go check to see if the rare plants survived the fire, or how they did. And I found thousands of that species in that area where there had only been like 6. And that repeated itself, that story repeated itself many places. So it was an adaptation of that species to fire. And it's one of the, from a management point of view, secondary reasons for reestablishing fire. It's because it enables a lot of diversity that might not be there otherwise. Another adaptation, this is fireweed. You might know its name. It's called fireweed for 2 reasons, but primarily because it follows fire. And it has little tiny seeds carried by the wind. And when there is a fire that leaves all this bare ground, or a volcano that leaves a lot of bare ground, it's one of the first things that's able to blow in and very quickly establish. It's also called fireweed, I think, because of its color. But it's kind of fire-looking. Just to digress, I had a contract 1 year to collect fireweed seed. And I just have to share with you that it wasn't a very happy experience. You can imagine fireweed seed. It's this little puffs of things that blow in the wind. And our whole house and our whole garage and me was totally covered with fireweed seed for a long time trying to process this. This is another fire. This is up north of Winthrop. This is the 30 Mile Fire. No, this is a Thunder Mountain Fire. I'm sorry. It's in the vicinity where that fire was 2 years ago where 4 people were killed. But I put this in just to show you that even big fires, this was considered a really big, large acreage fire. I don't know the number of acres. But I wanted to show you how patchy it is. That there's areas where it really was stand replacing, where it would have killed all the trees, and we'd expect a Doghair stand to come up in its place, lodgepole pine probably. But then it was really patchy, and there's lots of areas where there's a lot of surviving trees. And the plants and the animals both are really able to do fine with that. They're able to move around. It's not like they're totally wiped out. People talk about Yellowstone, you know, the big fire that really had big effects ecologically and politically. People go there now and say it's really the best thing that ever happened. That it's really increased habitat, and but it was viewed at the time as a big disaster.
Increased habitat for animals?
For lots of animals, yeah. And this again to show the patchiness of it. Here's a place where pretty complete fire where I'm standing. And just over there there's meadows that were essentially not affected. There's the high intensity. And the lodgepole, as well as being able to seed in after a fire, does a pretty good job of creating conditions that cause that kind of fire. So it's a pattern repeated for many species. They have a way of promoting fire and then of responding responding to the fire after it's over. How many people are from Minnesota? Just a little sidetrack. I was fortunate to go out to Minnesota and do a little study in the Boundary Waters Wilderness a few years ago. And I was really impressed by paper birch. Mm. Paper birch is the penultimate fire-adapted species. It's even got bark that's a perfect fire starter. Mm. It peels off in a fire and blows in the wind. You can imagine if you have a high wind and a hot fire going, that these pieces of bark go flying off the fire and spread the fire even further. In fact, those fires jump the lakes. I mean, when you get a hot fire in a place like that where there's a lot of birch, it can go long distance and spread. And then birch has like several adaptations to fire. It seeds germinate well in the aftermath, and it sprouts from the roots. So it's very adaptive. It's not like a fire bug,
though when they clear cut, the tree that comes back is poplar.
Right.
Yes, and the paper companies like that. They buy and use it for paper, but that's the way they talk about tree farming.
Right. Yeah, popple is another one. That's a very impressive tree also. We have it here, too. Mm-hmm.
Is there a hardwood out here in the west that is comparable? I mean, you mentioned Doug fir and lodgepole. On the west side, I think alder being pretty aggressive.
Yeah, alder is pretty aggressive if there's enough moisture. It's a good colonizer. We do have paper birch, not anywhere near as extensively. I mean, we do have aspen or popple, breaking aspen. Black cottonwood, if there's enough moisture. Cottonwood seed coats the world, you know. It's everywhere. And anywhere there's enough moisture, you'll get cottonwood. This is just another low-intensity fire. This is over in the edge of the sagebrush country, but near Steamboat Rock. But showing there was a fire went through here, and a lot of the trees have survived. And grasses are coming back. These are probably a little out of scope. This is just showing a fire, pretty high intensity fire, and even this is a wetland that was completely dried up and burned, and these are tules, or a type of bulrush, and they're actually coming back out of the ashes too. I wanted to close with these pictures, because I like to use the word disturbance as a neutral term, not meaning something is bad. Because the biggest disturbance is human effect. And this is out in the Waterville Plateau, where it's basically dry land wheat. And this area in the Palouse, I think this is the Palouse, the next picture, are probably among the most altered ecologies in the West. You know, we've changed the forest a lot by timber harvest and forest management and all that, but they're still basically forest land. And still have a mix of species. The Palouse is probably the most altered place I know in Washington, where every square inch that can be reached with a plow is farmed. And essentially 100% introduced species. And so I just put that in as a, again, not with a negative connotation at all, but just showing that human activity is really maybe the major disturbance in the ecology of the Northwest. So that's the end of those pictures. And we're kind of out of time. Maybe you could turn the light on. Turn the light on. This particular presentation is a little bit more 100% listen to me talk rather than listen to you talk. That's kind of the nature of the topic, so it's kind of the way it comes out. But if you'd like to have an opportunity to do something instead of just listen, I'm going to do a little twining workshop at 2 o'clock, which is making rope from bark. And so if you'd like to participate, that's like 90% you doing something, and only 10% listening to me. So please come to that, and I'll show you how people, well, around the world, but made rope and string out of bark. And I'll show you a couple of the things they've used here in particular. So thanks for coming.